All good. Okay. Okay. Good morning, everyone. Sorry for the late start. Parsha Shmini. It's interesting. In the normal years, Parsha Shmini, parshas come with a certain energy of the time of the year. So most years, Shmini means like it's after Pesach. That's what Shmini means, but not in a leap year. In a leap year, Shmini is always before Pesach, as it is this year. And what happens now in the book of Vayikra is that we have lots of small parshas, because a lot of the double parshas are in Vayikra, which means in a leap year, it's designed that way, because it's designed to land up that Bamidbar should be before Shavuot. So, because Shmini is very low, is very early because of the leap year, so now what happens is that all the double parshas of Vayikra become single parshas, we split them, and it's a lot of string of small parshas coming up, small ones, which means we can learn them more in depth, you see. Have more time to learn them, right? Okay. So just a quick overview on the parsha. We have in this parsha, we have the final day of the inauguration of the Mishkan. Vayehi b'yom hashmini was the eighth day. The Mishkan was built and ready to go on the 23rd of Adar, according to most opinions. It was then put up and taken down, dismantled for 7 days, known as the 7 days of practice, or miluim it's called, in other words, inauguration. And vayehi b'yom hashmini on the eighth day, which happened to turn out to be Rosh Chodesh Nisan, that was the final day that the Mishkan was erected, and then they brought sacrifices, and then we read in the Parsha that the Shekhinah eventually came to rest, and the fire came down from heaven, consumed the sacrifice, consumed the korbanos, and they saw that the Shekhinah had rested in the Mishkan. After that, we have the tragic story, which happened on the same day, actually. Interesting fact, it happened on the very same day that they inaugurated the Mishkan, the story of Nadav and Avihu, who brought fire that they shouldn't have brought, and they were killed by Hashem. Fire came out from heaven and consumed them. Towards the end of the parasha, we have kashrus, and then we have some of the laws of impurity and purity to do with food and with other things that come towards the end of the parasha. Okay. So what we're going to do, I'm going to just share with you something very short on Shmini, and then something longer on the section of kashrus. And then I'm also going to share with you something about this coming Shabbos, which is an additional parasha, one of the four special editions, which is Parshas Para, the red heifer, which we'll get to after we deal with Shemini. So let me just share the screen.
Should I put a screen behind you for the online people?
I think it's not bad. I see it's I think it looks right today. I think. Yeah. Hope so. I think that's the right screen. Yep, all good. Okay. So, if you have a look, just have a look at the number one. Everyone has the handout, yeah. So number one, we learned that Vayomer Moshe el Aaron, so as they were putting up the Mishkan, Aaron, of course, became the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. So Moshe Rabbeinu turns to Aaron and he says, Vayomer Moshe el Aaron, Moshe said to Aaron, Krav el HaMizbeach, come close to the Mizbeach, v'asei, Eschatascha v'esaylasecha, make the sin offering, the burnt offering, v'chaper ba'atcha u'ba'ad'om, atone for yourself and for the nation. Don't forget, part of the whole Mishkan was an atonement for the Egel Azor, for the golden calf. V'aseyes korbana'om, also you should prepare and you should bring the communal sacrifice that was behalf of the nation, v'chaper ba'adom, and atone for them, ka'asher tziva Hashem, as Hashem has commanded. Says Rashi, number two, Krav el HaMizbech, come close to the Mizbech. What is Moshe Rabbeinu? Why is Moshe Rabbeinu telling him to come close to the Mizbech? What does that mean? Says Rashi, Shehoyo Aaron Boish. Aaron was embarrassed, he was intimidated. V'yorei Logeshes, and he was fearful, he was scared to go anywhere close to the Mizbech. Didn't feel himself worthy, he was intimidated, he was overwhelmed by the enormity of the mission and the task that he had been given to be the Kohen Gadol. Says Rashi, according from a Medrash, Omar loy Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu said to him, Lomo ato boish, why are you embarrassed? Why are you bashful? Lakach nifcharto, for this you were chosen. Simple pshat being, this you were chosen, for, in other words, to bring the korbanos, you were chosen to go, be the Kohen Gadol, to come to the Mizbeach, to bring korbanos, to serve as a representative of the people, to bring their sacrifices, and so on and so forth. That's the idea. So I saw a beautiful little pshat in a sefer called Mayona Shel Torah. He brings, actually he doesn't even bring the name of the author, he brings the name of Svarim, which means multiple commentaries say the same thing. You have to read the Rashi a little bit differently. See, it says like this, Amaloi Moshe, Moshe said to him, right? Lama atoboish, why are you embarrassed or bashful? Lakach nifcharto, this is why you were chosen. So they explain it, this is why, meaning, this is why you were chosen, because you're bashful. Right? It's a different twist on the words. The reason that you are given this leadership is because you don't want it, because you are bashful. And this is true with lots of things. The best leaders are the ones that don't run after it. Ones that are intimidated by it. And the truth is, it's like that with everything. I once heard a nice little story about it. It was a shtetl in, it says that a shoychet, some of the shech's animals, has to be a big Yirei Shemayim, has to be a big God-fearing Jew, right? Because, you know, it's really, a shoychet means no one really knows what he does. Meaning, you check, you have sometimes oversight, you have a rav that checks his knife, that makes sure that he knows the knowledge, you can test him, he has to be qualified. But at the end of the day, when a shoychet comes and he shechs the animal, it's really between him and God. If he shechted it properly, it can be a nuance of a split second that no one will ever know. It's up to the shoychet. We trust the shoychet to say that the animal was shechted properly, and that makes a difference between a kosher animal and a non-kosher animal, right? So once a shoychet came to a rav and he says he wants to resign, just can't take the responsibility. He's very, very fearful for it. This is too much for him. He's scared, right? He's scared he's going to maybe do something wrong, he's going to make the animal trafe. He doesn't want the responsibility. So the rav turned to him and he said, can I ask you a question? Who should we give the mission of a shoychet to? Someone who's not scared. That's who you want to shech for the people? Someone who's not scared? No, you have to do it because you're scared. That's exactly why you have to continue doing it, right? Although on that note, I once heard a different story, a beautiful story actually. I've forgotten who it was. One of the greats, it was the Chafetz Chaim, I don't know exactly who it was. Someone came to me and says he resigned to be a sheikh. He doesn't want to be a sheikh anymore, too much responsibility. So the gadol, the great leader, asked him, so what do you plan to do? He says, you're going to become a teacher, malamed. So the gadol said to him, I don't understand you. You're overwhelmed and intimidated by the tremendous responsibility that you might make one animal treif, taka, a terrible thing. To someone who wants to eat a kosher animal and ends up being a treif animal, taka, a terrible thing. But at the end of the day, it's a one-time thing, and it's an animal at the end of the day. Terrible, you're right. Good, right to be scared about it, but you're gonna take the responsibility of raising kids that you're not scared of. You might shech the kids, in other words, you're not, right? Figuratively speaking, that you're not scared of. Anyway, so just that's a story told normally in the context of chinuch. But I thought it was just a very beautiful shot in this Rashi. It says, "Lama ato boish, why are you intimidated? Lakach nivcharta. That's why you were chosen, because you're bashful. That's the reason." Okay. Now, I want to go through something towards the end of the parasha, which is kashrus. And I have to be honest, I think I might have done this many years ago. So I'm sorry for the revision. But I might have shared some of it in different contexts. And I'll be perfectly honest, with Purim and everything, I needed something that wouldn't take me that long to prepare. So, I mean, I had to reread it and reload it, but it wasn't, so I'm being transparent about it. Okay. But I'm sure a little bit of revision. I like this word, so revising it won't, even if I did say it, revising it won't be a terrible thing. Okay, so we know at the end of the parasha, we have the laws of kashrus, right? Essentially, kosher animals, kosher birds, and kosher fish. Incidentally, with regard to kosher birds, and I've said this, I've definitely said this word, I don't know if for parasha shir or Thursday morning shir, but it's a beautiful word. It's a word I heard first from my grandfather when I was a child. One of the trefa birds, one of the non-kosher birds. It's interesting because the Torah tells us what the signs of a kosher animal is and a kosher fish. When it comes to the birds, it actually doesn't tell us, it tells us all the way around. It tells us the list of non-kosher birds, right? Which in itself is interesting because we're actually not even sure exactly what they all are. And therefore, today we are signs of a, there are signs that we do know that a kosher bird, the Gemara says, but today we only stick to birds that we have what's called a Masor, we have a tradition. We know from generations that these are kosher birds. On that, while we're talking, there was a, that's why there was a big tumult, a big how to do, where when turkey was introduced into the market, which wasn't that long, relatively speaking. I think it came from India originally, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's called Tarnagol Hodu in Hebrew. I'm not sure about that, but there was a big thing. What was the question? The question is, it certainly had the signs of a kosher bird, according to the way the Gemara explains it, but it was a question whether it really has a Masur, does it have a tradition? The question was, really, do we treat it as its own animal, or do we treat it as part of the chicken family? Right? In other words, so that's part of the Masur, part of the tradition of chickens, which we know to be kosher. So at the end of the day, mainstream halacha, most poskim, accepted that it is part of the chicken family, and it's okay, it's part of the Masaira, and it's okay to eat, and an overwhelming majority of the kosher world eats turkey. It's very good, by the way. Smoked turkey is very good. However, there was one great Kabbalist in Germany, his name was the Shalach HaKadosh, a great Makubal, Shmuel Halevi Horowitz, I think his name was. He preferred not to eat it, and he left some sort of, because he wasn't 100% sure about it, and although he didn't oppose the general psak, the general ruling in halacha, he did instruct his family and his descendants that they shouldn't eat it. So I do know, I have a cousin that on his mother's side is a descendant of the Shalom, and he doesn't eat turkey. And there are people around that don't eat turkey because they come from the Shalom HaKadosh, and they don't eat turkey, but otherwise it's considered kosher. However, one of the trefa birds in the parasha is called chasido. It surely means kindness, right? That's what that word means. And the Gemara says, it's a non-kosher word. I'm not sure what it is in English, but why is it called chasida? Says the Gemara, she'oise chesed im chavrei seho, because it's a bird that does kindness with its friends, right? So the Mefarshim asked the question, then why is it a treifa bird? The truth is that we have, I mean, obviously kashrus is a choik, it's a mitzvah without a reason necessarily, but nevertheless we do know that a lot of the non-kosher birds are predators and they have bad character traits, which is part of the explanation of why they're treif. So if there's a bird that does chesed with its friends, why is it treif? Why is it a non-kosher bird? Right? And the answer is, in the wording, if you look at carefully, the answer is, she'oise chesed im chavrei seho. It does kindness, but only with its friends. Im chavrateh, which means with its friends, that's not kindness. To do selective kindness only with people you like, that's not considered kindness, that's part of the non-kosher birds. Anyway, that's nothing. Okay. But now we know that when it comes to animals, the signs of a kosher animal is two signs, split hoofs and chewing the cud. Okay. And the signs of kosher fish is fins and scales. Okay. So there's a very fascinating Mishnah in the Mishnah. So if you have a look at number 3. First it talks about the fish, and then it talks about animals. Okay. It says like this. Kol sheyesh lo kaskeses. This is a famous thing with regard to fish. Any fish that has scales, yesh lo snapir, for sure has fins. Now, by the way, that's a huge halachic thing. If we discover fish, and the fish clearly has scales, even though we can't see the head, we don't know if it has fins, you don't have to worry about it. In fact, the Gemara has a whole question why the Torah has to even mention fins. Because, I mean, we'll see part of the explanation of what we're going to share, but the truth is that really you only need one sign of a kosher fish, scales, that's it. If it has scales, you know it's kosher. Because if it has scales, for sure it has fins. Now, by the way, scales have to be defined, a certain size, that make it scales, whatever, but I'm saying it's a concept of scales. Scales is one of the simonim of a kosher fish. If it has scales, it has fins. Okay. However, says the Mishnah, v'yesh sheyesh lo snapri, there are fish that have fins, but v'ein lo kaskeses, do not have scales. So if you see a fish that's got fins, that doesn't mean it's a kosher fish necessarily. You have to see that it's got scales. Okay. Then the Mishnah continues with another thing with regard to animals. Kol sheyesh lo karnayim, any animal that has horns, now horns are not one of the signs of a kosher animal, but if you see an animal that has horns, yesh lo tlafim, it means it has hoofs. Animals do not have hoofs unless they have horns as well. Sorry, no, that's not true. An animal does not have horns unless it has hoofs as well, as I would say. Right? So if you see an animal with horns, it means it's got hoofs. Right? Sorry? V'yeshla, yeah. However, says the Mishnah, v'yesh yeshla tlafayim, there are those animals that have hoofs, split hoofs, but if ain't looking like that, they don't have horns. Which isn't the problem, by the way. It doesn't make it unkosher. If it's got split hoofs and it chews its guard, it's kosher. Just telling us a fact that there are animals that have split hoofs but do not have horns. Okay? Which actually is a strange Mishnah, because why do we need to know this? Like, what's the... Because actually, no, the first part we understand. The first part means if you have scales, that's okay. You can ding it. If you can eat it. If it's got fins, no. Not necessarily does it have scales. If it's not necessarily kosher. The next part is more of like a general knowledge thing. If it's got horns, it has hoofs. If it has hoofs, but not necessarily has horns, but so what? Okay. It's still kosher if it chooses the cut, right? Okay. So this Mishnah was once explained. I've shared this with you before. After, in 1994, after the Babbage Rebbe passed away, they discovered, in addition to his vast volumes of Torah teaching and so on and so forth, they discovered in his drawer two thick folders of what we call Rishimus. Rishimus were notes that he wrote for himself. The Rebbe had a very interesting style that when he spoke very long and detailed, like he would explain something with great detail. When he wrote with extreme brevity. Note, you have to manage to decipher it. Like it's very, very hard to understand. And he didn't write many sforim himself. Most of the books we have from the Rebbe are what was transcribed from his talks and the edited later. But if he wrote something for himself, it was very, very brief. For example, coming out to Pesach, the first book that the Rebbe did write was an explanation on the Haggadah. He has his own Haggadah, which is also very, very halachic, very about different reasons and preferences. Lots and lots of references. You see an amazing, vast knowledge of references there, but it's very brief, very, very briefly written, because he wrote it himself. So they found this book, two thick folders of stuff that he'd written for himself, some of which he had never talked about, just was his own learning. On some of it, it says he was planning to say it, but he never actually said it. Some of it were just things he wrote for himself, but very, very deep stuff, and sometimes very involved. And they started, I think, to publish it, and they worked on it. Each piece, each essay was worked and was published with extra notes to make it for clarity and references and so on and so forth. And there's some wonderful, amazing insights there. One of the insights is a piece on this parasha, on Parasha Shmini, and it's on this Mishnah. Okay. So just to give you a little bit of a background, which he doesn't speak about in this particular note, but he does speak about other places. There's a famous halachic analysis, from a great Torah sage called the Rogat Shover, which the Rebbe used to like very much, he used to quote him very often. And he talks about the simanim, the signs of kashrus on fish and on animals. And he poses a halachic discussion, halachic analysis, about the nature of these signs. Meaning, are they signs that have nothing to do with the kashrut of the animal, just so happens to be? That all, if you group all the kosher animals together, they share a common sign. But in other words, not the split hoofs and the chewing the cud that make the animal kosher. The animal's kosher because the Torah says it's kosher. It just happens to be, if you take all the animals that are kosher and you group them together, you'll see they happen to share a sign, which makes it easier for us to identify a kosher animal, which is that they have split hoofs and they chew the cud. Or is the pshat differently? The pshat is, do they make the animal kosher? Now, is the kashrut created because it split hooves and chews the cud? Now, I mention that because that has all sorts of halachic ramifications, which I'm not going to go into now, but it certainly has ramifications of how we explain the halacha spiritually speaking. You look confused.
I can't see the difference.
Why is a cow kosher? Because it has... Is it that it has split hooves and chews the cud so we know it's kosher, but it's not that's not what made them kosher? Or is the pshat is, no, that Hashem says that there's a group of animals that have these two simanim, these two signs, and they're kosher because the sign actually makes them kosher. That's what contributes to the kashrut of the animal. I'll give you a halachic ramification. Let's say a cow gave birth to a calf and didn't have the signs. Now, it's almost an impossibility that, but let's say it didn't, right? Were you genetically modified in such a way where it was born without hoofs? So is it kosher? No, right? That's the question. Okay. So at least in a spiritual way, the way the Rebbe always accepts it is that the signs create the kashrus. Okay. So with that, he explains the Mishnah in the following way. First of all, the Mishnah is talking about two different types of people. Or, let's say, two different types of experiences within a person's life. So we always know that fish and animals, right? Fish and animals represent two different types of experiences or two different types of creations. Fish who are immersed in the water always represent, Kabbalistically we find this a lot, a spiritual experience, immersed, because water is a symbol of spirituality, water is a symbol of purity. Being immersed in the water, also being immersed in the water means for fish that they are totally connected to their source of life. In other words, if you take a fish out of water, it dies. In other words, like its dependence on its source of life is obvious, which represents a type of creation that is more sensitive to its spiritual source, like the malachim, or like the angels, or like neshamas, which in other words, which are obviously connected to where they derive their life from. So that's fish. Animals are on ground. The ground always is a lower level. In other words, more coarse, more material, more materialistic, more mundane, and so on, right? That's why Kabbalistically we have this concept that in Kabbalah it says that you can find whatever's that the two, the ocean and the earth represent the two worlds, as Kabbalah refers to them, called the hidden worlds and the revealed worlds. The hidden worlds are the lofty worlds that are too high for us to comprehend. The real world is this world, which is relates to us more because it's less conscious of its spiritual source, a spiritual connection. Okay. How that translates, it translates into different types of people or different types of experiences of people. So when I say different types of people, the way he divides it up in this particular essay is, you have people whose mission it is to be involved and immersed much more in spirituality. People, the great people who sit there all day and learn, or daven, great tzaddikim, whatever, etc., etc. And then you have the people who are like involved in the world, business people, or I mean, they keep all the mitzvahs, that's their mission, to be involved and engaged with the physical world. Or a different way to divide it up is within the same person itself, because that's the way we know. We know that those roles do divide between people, but also they divide between our own life. Right? There are parts of our life where we're supposed to be like fish, learning, davening, where we're supposed to be totally immersed in the world of spirituality, so we become like fish during that time. And then and we're much more focused on our soul than our animal soul. We're more nurturing our soul, our neshama, like learning and davening is much more an experience of the neshama than it is for the body. And then there are times of the day where we have to be much more engaged with our, what we call our nefesh habam, is our animal soul, where we interact with the world, we interact with the physical, with food, with business, with interaction with the physical world at large. Okay. And this is what the Mishnah is talking about. So he explains the first one first. It says like this. With the role of people, with fish-type people, or fish-type experiences, if you have scales, you have fins. If you have fins, you don't necessarily have scales. What does that mean? So let's see how I explain scales and fins, and then we'll put it together. Very, very beautiful idea. Scales represents protection. Because what is scales? Scales like a shield over the fish. Protection from spiritually threatening ideas, spiritually threatening sources. So scales represent, for the person who is going through this experience, protection to make sure that they stay on course and they don't deviate from their godly consciousness and their spiritual mission. That's what scales represent. What that translates to in Torah learning, for example, those that are immersed in a more spiritual experience of learning Torah, whether it's the people who learn full-time or the person who is dedicating part of his or her day to Torah learning, it represents the idea of Yirat Shamayim, of fear of heaven. We know that one of the things that we do, as much as we value and as much as we critically insist, so to speak, in Yiddishkeit, that a person must be involved in learning, but learning cannot be done as an academic subject. Learning must be done with Yirat Shamayim, with fear of heaven, meaning a dedication to being fearful of what Hashem's commands are, what His mission is, what His purpose is, and the surrender to the holiness of Torah and the surrender to the transcendence of Torah, that at the end of the day, it's a logic which is beyond us. It's true, it's absolute truth, it's absolute authenticity, and so on and so forth, right? So why is that so important? Because while Torah learning is so important, but it's also by definition, Torah learning is an academic experience by design, right? Different to mitzvahs. Mitzvahs can be done with total submission. At the end of the day, it's not great because we need to put our own understanding into it, and we shouldn't be enthusiastic about it and passionate about it. But actually, the basis of keeping all mitzvahs is submission. That's the bottom line, right? God said, we do. Understand, don't understand, it makes no difference. We do it anyway. Now, it's good to understand as much as we can. Of course, mishpatim, we're supposed to understand certain mitzvahs. At the end of the day, it doesn't affect the mitzvah. You do a mitzvah because Hashem said so, brilliant. Do dedication, surrender, submission, fantastic. That's what mitzvah is all about. Torah learning is the other way around. Torah learning is we're supposed to understand Hashem's wisdom, right? So we're supposed to use our mind. We're supposed to use our own independent mind. We're supposed to use our own intellectual creativity. We're supposed to understand, ask questions, analyze, and so on and so forth. So therefore, learning has a danger to it. Because as soon as we stick ourselves into the process, it's always dangerous, right? We always get in our own way. That's the bottom right rule of everything in life, right? I always say this, as you know, contrary to what modern society tells you to trust yourself and your instincts, bad idea. Because we're always biased, we always get in our own way. Now, when we learn, that becomes tricky because we're supposed to trust ourselves. We're supposed to defend our own thinking. And that's why, as a protection, we have to have scales. Scales is important for the fish, important for the Torah learner. We always have to make sure, are we sticking with the truth? This is what Hashem wants us to do. Are we distorting Hashem's wisdom? Are we deviating from the axioms of the absolute, you know, basic foundations of truth? Are we concluding and misinterpreting the learning to arrive at wrong halachic conclusions, which is even worse, right? We know if a person learns a blood, you know, piece of Gemara and he's not a rabbi and he's not paskening any shaila and he happens to interpret wrong, no, not the end of the world. But if you come and you make a new halacha because of it, which happens unfortunately. With people who don't have the right level of Yirat Shamayim, you make up stuff and you learn wrong interpretations and you deviate from the authentic truth, that can be a disaster, right? So that's why scales are so important when you learn. Protection. What does fins represent? He says fins represent the idea of being creative in learning. Chidush, as we call it in Hebrew, right? Now, that's something the Zohar talks about, and it's talked about a lot. There is an idea to come up with your own, we call it your own chidushim, your own creative ideas in Torah, right? That's why we have volumes and volumes and libraries of svarim that were written on learning throughout the generations. People that have, you know, taken a piece of Gemara, analyzed it, asked questions, created a contradiction between the Rambam in two different places, or looked at a dispute between Rashi and Tosfos, and then come up with a novel way of understanding it and interpreting it, right? So that's Chiddush, that's the idea of Chiddush. Why is that represented in fins, the Rebbe says? Because fins is the idea of swimming, like you swim fast, right? It takes you from point A to point B in a dramatic way. It's a complete change from point A to point B. That's what fins are. So therefore, the way he interprets it is that fins is the concept of creativity, the concept of Chiddush. Yep. So he says the following. If you learn Torah properly, meaning, if you have scales, then you'll have fins. If you learn Torah with a proper dedication, the proper emunah, with a proper submission, with a proper surrender to Hashem's wisdom, without deviating, without anything, Hashem will help. Hashem will give you the power to be creative, and your chidushim, your innovations, your creativity, will be part of a kosher fish, because you started off with scales. If you have scales, you have fins. But if you only have fins, it doesn't mean you have scales, and therefore it doesn't mean you're a kosher fish. There are many people who are creative in Torah learning, and yet aren't kosher, because if you're creative but you don't have the Yirat Shamayim, you don't have the protection, the spiritual protection when you learn. You're just only going your own route and you're coming up with your own creative innovations, but they're not actually based on the true humility and the true submission to true authentic Torah learning. They might be fins. They might be a completely dramatic jump from point A to point B, but it's not a kosher Torah. It's not kosher fish because you don't have the scales. And that's how explains the Mishnah, that whoever has scales has fins, but if it has fins, it not necessarily has scales. Okay. That's the first part of the Mishnah. Then comes the second part of the Mishnah. The second part of the Mishnah is with animals. Now we're talking about different kind of people. We're talking about people who engage in the world. Or the parts of our life when we engage in the more physical, which is most of our lives for most of us, right? Meaning we're engaged with the world. What does that actually mean? What does it mean to be engaged with the world? To be engaged with the world means to do ultimately what Hashem wants, which is to bring Hashem into the world, right? That's why we do that, right? Yep. Hashem wants us to engage with the world because He wants us to elevate the world. And He wants us to bring godliness into the world. He wants us to reveal the creative force in the world and so on and so forth. Right? Now that's a complicated journey. That's a very complicated journey. So we do that first of all, not just with mitzvahs, we do that first of all with some of the mitzvahs, most of the mitzvahs actually. As we know, most of our mitzvahs are physical. That's what Yiddishkeit is all about, because that's the purpose of Yiddishkeit, to bring Hashem into the physical world. So we have mitzvahs that aren't physical. We have mitzvahs like belief in Hashem, love of Hashem, fear of Hashem, which are not physical mitzvahs, but most of our mitzvahs are physical. It's either about the physical things we're not supposed to do or the physical things we have to do. I mean, coming up to Pesach, every bit of Pesach is physical. It's about which chametz is good, which chametz isn't good, how we have to clean the house, and then how we have to tell the story and drink four cups of wine, eat more and eat matzah. It's all physical stuff, right? Okay. So that's what, obviously they represent a spiritual journey, but it's physical, it's connecting it to the physical. It's bringing the spiritual concept into the physical and the godly consciousness into the physical. But it's not just mitzvahs. That's a big mistake people make. It's not just mitzvahs. It's actually our whole life, right? So as the Pasuk says, well, there's two sayings that we find in the Pesukim or in the Gemara. One is, Kol ma'asecha yulashem shemayim. Whatever you do should be for the sake of heaven. In other words, whatever we do, even if it's not mitzvah related, it might just be having a meal or having a snack or sleeping or business or entertainment, whatever it is, right? Whatever we do should be l'shem shemayim. Or even deeper than that, it says, b'chol derachecha da'eir. In all your ways and everything that you do, you should know Hashem. Right? In other words, serving Hashem, as the Mishnah says, Ani lo nivresi elo l'shamash eskeni. I was not created only to serve my master. And therefore the true ultimate yid is someone that whatever they do, mitzvah or no mitzvah, mitzvah or neutral, right? Mitzvah is just part of what we do. It's a symbol of what we do, but it's much more than just mitzvahs. Whether we eat or whether we do business or whether we help someone, whatever we're doing, right? Whatever a person does in their life should be part of their avodas Hashem, part of their serving of Hashem. Okay? That is not an easy thing, but it's in fact a very difficult thing, right? It's difficult for many reasons. First of all, the lines are very blurry. To use a simple example, when we eat, right? Lines are very blurry. Are we eating to be healthy to serve Hashem, or are we eating because it's a good shtickl steak? Right? That's, right? Yeah, okay, so we try, we make a bracha before, we think about it before. But it's not an easy path, it's not an easy journey, and it's not also an all or nothing journey. In other words, and I'm saying that because it's relevant to the explanation we're going to give. In other words, sometimes we do it a bit better, sometimes we do it a bit worse. It's hard to get perfection. It's actually life's journey. That's what the whole journey of life is. To come to a point where more and more each day we do everything, we bring more of what we do in life generally to be part of our avodas Hashem. So when it comes to mitzvahs, okay, that's something we can strive to keep all the mitzvahs. Okay, that's different. That's finite, that's defined, right? So you can have a person that, we'll make mistakes even in mitzvahs, but at least it's defined. So we know what it is to keep kosher, we know what it is to keep Shabbos, to keep our Shulchan Aruch, to keep halacha, whatever the case is. But this is much more than just mitzvahs or halacha, that's what I'm saying. It's a whole journey of life. To be engaged in the world means that everything that we do that is worldly or material, we do it to serve Hashem, and therefore it's not all or nothing, it's we keep on growing in that direction, in that journey. But it's also fraught with danger. Why is it fraught with danger? Because any time we engage with the world, it's dangerous. It's very simple, right? It's more dangerous than what we can do in learning Torah. It's very dangerous because the world is a tempting place. The world is a challenging place. There are many parts of the world that when we engage in it, we're not serving Hashem, and we're actually drawn away from serving Hashem, or we're spiritually damaged. And the world is a very, as we know, the word olam means la'alim, to hide. The world is a place that hides Hashem's presence. And therefore, it is very difficult and complicated and not always easy to be engaged with the world and be elevating the world rather than the world being influencing us. That's a very difficult journey, right? So to do that, we have to have certain simanim, we have to have certain signs. That's interesting. In this particular essay, he only deals with the signs of hoofs. He doesn't deal with the sign of chewing the cud, which he deals with in other places, in other sikhot, in other talks. So I'll tell you the hoofs one. I'll tell you both, because so we have to. How do we create a kosher animal, right? Because this journey of being engaged in the world is not the fish part of who we are; it's the animal part of who we are. It's the nefesh abamis. It's the animal soul. So first of all, we have to have split hoofs. Now it goes more than just split hoofs. First of all, we have to have hoofs altogether. What's a hoof? A hoof raises the animal above the ground, right? And that's a really hard thing to do. In other words, we have to be engaged with the world, yet always separate from the world. That's a very, one of the symbolism of that. He doesn't talk about it here, but it's a famous idea. You know that in Yiddishkeit, in the Gemara, we are told that shoes is a very, very important thing. You know that? Shoes. In fact, when we make the morning brachas to thank Hashem for the clothes that we wear, shoes is not included in that bracha. Like we make a bracha, malbish aramim, that Hashem clothes those that are naked. And we have a special bracha for shoes, where we word it very interesting. We say, sha'asali kol tzarki, you've given us all our needs, and it refers to shoes. The Gemara is very emphatic that shoes is a very important thing to have. In fact, traditionally, I know my father was hugely strict on this. Traditionally, Yidden didn't walk barefoot. It was considered a very not nice thing to wear barefoot. Yeah, you ever heard that before?
Yes.
My father used to tell me, "Megatnish Borvis, you don't go barefoot." Barefoot was considered a very like not nice thing.
Of course, you're in the earth.
Oh, yeah. So what's the reason? The reason is because you always have to have a separation between you and the earth. Now, what's interesting is we find exceptions to that, right? For example, we find in the Beis Hamikdash, the Kohanim had to serve and bring Kabbalah as dafka barefoot. They weren't allowed to wear anything on their feet. And we also find that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to the burning bush and Hashem called him to come close, he told him, Shalna alecha ma'al raglecha, take your shoes off your feet. Why? Ki admas koydushu, because he's standing on holy ground. That's the point. The point is that when you're standing on holy ground, you don't need shoes. In fact, you shouldn't have shoes because you shouldn't be disconnected. You should connect. But that's very special grounds, like the ground of the Beis Hamikdash, or the ground of near Har Sinai, where Moshe Rabbeinu had this amazing godly vision. Right? Hashem said, you're standing on holy ground, take your shoes off. But most of the time, we're not engaged with holy ground, at least in an obvious sense. We're engaged with ground, which represents the earthliness, the coarseness, and the mundaneness of the world, which we have to be engaged with. But before you can engage, you have to separate. You have to say, it's not my home. I'm engaged with it, but it's not me. Because as soon as it's you, it won't elevate you, it will draw you down. That's just Yiddishkeit's formula from beginning to end. We have to always have this consciousness of being above the ground, separate from the ground. Part of the shoe idea as well, right? And that's represented in the siman of the kosher animal that makes it kosher, which is the hoof. Before we get the split hoof. Now the split hoof is also a concept, which doesn't talk about here so much. The split hoof we've talked about before, the idea of having a split hoof, that you have to have the ability to go against your personality. So the split hoof represents the chesed and the gvura thing. So you can do both. You can do both parts. You can have chesed, you can have gvura, go against your nature, all part of the journey. But over here he focuses on this concept. You have to be detached from earthliness. You have to have a hoof. Now, says the Mishnah like this. If an animal has horns, it for sure has hoofs. What does that mean? The horn represents elevation. The horn represents someone who has reached a sort of level of perfection in mastering the art of engaging with the world. Right? That's what that represents. Great tzaddik or person who's been immersed in this for years, whatever the case is. So says the Mishnah, if a person has horns, a person has perfected this process of engaging with the world properly, being an animal, guaranteed to have a hoof. Because you can never get to any level of perfection, even less than perfection, in elevating the world without being detached from the world. The Mishnah is trying to emphasize, don't think there's another route, because there isn't. There's no other route, there's no other way. You have to create a separation between you and the physical. And then engage with it as a foreigner. Not as a not as someone who lives there, right? However, says the Mishnah, that doesn't mean that if you have a hoof, you're going to have horns. It doesn't mean if you have a hoof, you're going to reach perfection. Nor do you need to reach perfection. In other words, that doesn't mean that to be a kosher animal, you have to have horns. This is the point. Because to be a kosher animal just means you have to be on the journey. It doesn't mean you have to have horns. Therefore, the Mishnah says, just because you have horns, if you have horns, for sure, you only got there because you have hoofs, for sure. There's no other formula. But don't think that that's the only way to become kosher. Because if you have hoofs, it's still a kosher animal, even though you don't have horns. Because you have the growth, you have the chesed and the gevura, you're trying, you have the separation. As long as you're on the journey, and you always feel yourself detached from earthliness, and that's your journey, that's your aspiration, that's your direction, that's the kosher animals. Are you not at such a high madrega yet? Sometimes you do make a mistake. Sometimes you eat the meal because it's kishmak, not because you want to serve Hashem. Or you get involved with the world, maybe like, okay, but that's not you. You have hoofs. You're above the ground, and that's your journey. Your journey is to serve Hashem. Your aspiration, your mindset, is to serve Hashem in everything that you do. Right? That's a kosher animal. Even if you don't have hoofs. And therefore, not everyone that has hoofs has horns. Yeah. It's a great formula.
That's why I said the signs of
a... Make the kashrus. Right,
and
exactly.
What was the other sign?
That just happens to be, that's how we know who they are. He says, no, it's not just identification. They make the kashrus, because that's what it symbolizes, right? How do we become a kosher animal? How do we make our own animal soul kosher? We have to have split hooves. Well, we also have to chew the cud, by the way, which in another place explains means reviewing and reflection, thinking, always having that consciousness before you make a decision to know that it's not so easy to make a decision when you engage with the world. You have to know that, what is kosher, what is not kosher, ask a question, review it. That's the idea of chewing the cud, break it down, and so on and so forth, right? All these things. They make the same thing with fish. Torah learning is critical to serving Hashem. What makes the kosher process of Torah learning? Scales. You have to have protection. It's not just a sign, it makes the kashrut. That protection creates the kashrut of your Torah learning, of your spiritual experience. Otherwise, it can be a spiritual experience totally deviating from the authentic truth. Yeah, of course. Yeah, the ones. Yeah, then has to be shechted. That's another discussion about what shechting means and how that's part of also the process of kashrut. That's another time. But you're right, because the shechting animal, the Kalman says, shechting animal actually elevates the animal. So you're right. You can't eat the animal unless you shecht it first, which is another whole discussion. Okay. So that's just a little interesting explanation on the Mishnah that deals with kashrus, which was written on this week's parasha, because it deals with these signs of kashrus. Just very briefly, then let's go to the next part of the Shabbos, which is Parshas Poro. It's the law of the red heifer. Now, just to give a little bit of a context like this. So first of all, the law of the red heifer is a complicated law. It's the process. We have in Torah this concept of Tumah and Tara, purity and impurity, different levels of purity and impurity, different kinds, one of the most complex laws in Torah study. But we know that the most of the time, the way someone becomes purified from an impure state is mikveh. That's the normal tool of purifying oneself that happens in the Torah. With one exception, that is the exception if someone comes in contact with a dead body. But then a person contracts the high level of tumah, the high level of impurity, and that's a big problem. And the only way to purify is through the process of para aduma, the red heifer. So the red heifer was, we have nine red heifers to date. The tenth will be when Mashiach comes. So the Torah gives us the command to take a para aduma, a cow which is completely red, completely, not even two black hairs, to shecht it as a korban in a very particular way, to then bring it up as a burnt offering, not on the mizbech, it was brought outside, it was completely burnt to ashes. Those ashes were then mixed with pure water, mayim chaim, spring water, in a very, very carefully done way. And that solution was then sprinkled on a person who became tameh over a period of 7 days, on the third day and on the seventh day, and only then they can go to mikveh and then they become pure. Okay, that's the concept. Why do we read it the Shabbos, right? So we know like this, because one of the at this time of the year, during the Beis HaMikdash, this was always the time of the year when Paradim will be a discussion. Because the one korban that everyone had to bring, or everyone had to be involved in and eat on the same day, but as an individual korban, rather as a communal korban, was the korban Pesach, right? So just so you understand, so in the Beis HaMikdash, there were different types of sacrifices. There were what we call communal korbanos, which on behalf of the whole Klal Yisrael, like the daily offerings, the Musaf offerings, and so on and so forth. Now they were brought by a select group of people, Kohanim, some Levim, and then every week there was a different group of representation from the general population. All good. And they did their trick, and they atoned, and they elevated the whole Jewish people. But if someone was living in Tel Aviv, or Haifa, or Tzvas, or whatever, and they were Tomei, and they happened to come into contact with a dead body, it didn't interfere with the process of the korbanos at all, right? Because they weren't there. They didn't have to be pure. They were fine. Obviously, eventually, if they wanted to go to the Beis HaMikdash, they'd have to go through the Parah Aduma process, but not now. It wasn't urgent, right? Then we have korbanos, which were individual sacrifices. So if someone sinned, they would go to the Beis HaMikdash, they'd offer up a sin offering. If someone wanted to just do a present for Hashem, bring a burnt offering. If someone wanted to thank Hashem for different things, it was a korban todah. It was called a thanksgiving offering. All these different things. A woman gave birth, eventually had to bring a sacrifice. All different types of individual korbanos that people brought, right? But they were brought by the individual when it became relevant, right? Either if something particularly happened where Hashem said you had to bring a korban, or was a donation. Whenever it became relevant, that individual would then have to go and bring a korban. Which meant that obviously they would have to make sure that they're pure, and then they haven't come into contact with any impurity and so on, and go to the Beis HaMikdash. The only time we had people bringing and partaking in an individual korban all on the same day is korban Pesach. Korban Pesach was a unique korban because it had properties of an individual korban. It was an individual responsibility, but yet it was the only individual korban that has a designated day to bring it on, right? That you had to bring it on that particular day, which was Erev Pesach, which meant that Klal Yisrael, everyone that was going up to Yerushalayim for Pesach, and that was an encouraged thing, it was a mitzvah to go up, all had to go and bring this korban. They don't all have to be in the Beis HaMikdash, but there was groups, and there was one representative of the group, but then they all have to eat that korban that night. That's part of the Seder. Part of the Seder is they would eat a kazayit of korban Pesach, right? So therefore, coming up to Nisan, they would call an urgent call to everyone to make sure that if anyone, to learn the laws of Parah Aduma, of Red Heifer. Because if anyone then had any problems, they'd come into contact, they'd gone to a funeral, whatever the case might be, or whatever reason they'd come into contact with a dead body, everyone had now the obligation to make sure that they went through the process of purification through the Parah Aduma, which would then facilitate them to bring the Korban Pesach. Right? Which is why we read it at this time of the year. We do this with all the four parshas, right? So just like the first one, which was Shkalim, we read because that was the time of the year they used to bring the half a shekel. So too over here, this time of the year. Now we do it before, the way it works is, we always do it on the Shabbos before we do the last one of the four parshiyos, which is Achodesh, which we're going to do next Shabbos. What's Achodesh? That's the one we read about the mitzvah of making the calendar and the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. Now, so how does it work? Chodesh is always read either on the Shabbos before Nisan, or if Rosh Chodesh Nisan is on Shabbos, like this year, we read Chodesh on that Shabbos. That's next week. Not the Shabbos, a week from Shabbos. So a week from Shabbos in Shul, we're going to take out three Torahs, because we're going to have the Parsha and Rosh Chodesh and HaChodesh, right? Which is the fourth of the four Parshias. And therefore, because it's going to be next week, so therefore this week, we skipped out last Shabbos. We didn't read anything special last Shabbos. But this coming Shabbos, we're going to read Parah, because Parah is always the Shabbos before Chodesh. That's how it works. Okay. And that's why this week is called Parshas Parah. A lot of opinions hold it's an obligation to hear Parshas Parah. Whatever the case is, it's part of the kriya of this particular parsha. I was going to go to something much longer, but I'll just mention it briefly. So, if you have a look in the Chumash, have a look at number four. This is the first two pesukim. Vayadaber Hashem al Moshe v'al Aaron Lemer. Right? It says to Moshe and Aaron saying, Zois chukas ha-Torah, this is the statute of this is the law of the Torah. Shetziv Hashem Leimer, Hashem commanded. Dabar Rabbanei Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people. Yikvei Lecha, and they should bring for you Parah Aduma Tzmima, a red, perfect cow. Asher ein mumum that has no blemish, asher olo olo her oil. One of the conditions of the cow was also nothing, the cow had not worked. It hadn't been carrying any yoke or anything. It had to be innocent, pure, right from birth. Okay, and then it goes to all the laws, and that's what we read in this parasha. One of the questions on this pasuk is, why does it, we know that it's called a chukah, it's a very difficult mitzvah to understand. Even Shlomo HaMelech, who said he understood, even the chukim, but this one he didn't understand, it's the ultimate chukah. But the question is, why does it say, Zois chukas ha-Torah? This is the chukah, chukah means a mitzvah we don't understand, of the Torah. Why doesn't it say, Zois chukas ha-Porah? Right, this is the law of the Porah Adumah. So there are many, many answers. I'll just share with you one brief idea, and that is like this. That there was a certain formula in this mitzvah that actually represented something that is true with all mitzvahs, and it actually connects a bit to what we spoke about before. We know there's a concept which we've talked about many times called Ratzu V'Shuv. Ratzu V'Shuv means, it's based on a pasuk in Tanakh where Yecheskel saw the celestial vision, and he saw the angels, and he saw they were running and then coming back. Running and coming back. So we have that formula in the way we serve Hashem also. There's this concept of running away from the world, trying to connect to something higher, and then realizing that Hashem says that's great, but we have to also come back. Right? This parsha, for example, the story of Nadav and Avihu, the Or HaChaim explains that was their problem. They were actually great tzaddikim, but they had ratzu without the shuv. They went into ecstasy, they wanted to come close to Hashem, they resented the lowly existence of this world, and they reached that. That's exactly what happened. They got their wish, then Hashem left their bodies and joined with Hashem. That was wrong because the purpose is to serve Hashem in the world. But, as we said before, in order to create a disconnect with the world, you have to also have ratzu all the time, right? You have to run away from the world and then come back to the world. So that's a whole formula. A whole day works like that. A whole life works like that. We work, we get up in the morning, we run away from the world because we daven and we learn. Then we go back into the world. Then a whole week we're in the world, we have Shabbos. Then at the end of Shabbos, we get thrust back into the world. On a more broader sense, we have the month of Tishrei, completely spiritual months, then we get put into the world. Then we long for another Tishrei, then we get it, then we have to go back into the world again. So it's always back and forth, right? We energize ourselves by the spiritual experiences, and then we come back. So in a way, that concept, it explains in many places, is very much hinted in Parah Adumah, this mitzvah. That's why it's called not just a mitzvah of the Parah Adumah, it's called the mitzvah of the Torah. Why? Because one of the ways this mitzvah was done is it was a combination of fire and water. The Parah Adumah had to be burnt, and then the ashes had to be mixed with pure spring water. Fire is a symbol of Ratzu. It always fire rises, always going higher, trying to connect something higher. Water, the nature of water is the pouring from down up to below. Water comes down, pours down, right? So water is like the idea of Chesed. The fire is Gevurah, and so on and so forth. So that's why in Hasidic teachings, fire is always the symbol of Ratzu. It's going up, up, up. Love of Hashem, passion. Water is always the calmness and the coming down to the world. Therefore, because Parah Adumah is the mixture of fire and water, the Torah says, Zois chukas ha-Torah, this is the mitzvah of the Torah, not just the mitzvah of Parah Adumah, because actually it's a symbol for everything that we do in Torah mitzvahs and the way we serve Hashem. Okay?